from the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin, welcome to The Surgery Set. I'm Jonathan Kohler, an assistant professor in pediatric surgery here in Madison. I'm new here, and with this podcast, I'm exploring the ideas, inventions, and innovations of our department, plus meeting a lot of really interesting people. I'm excited for you to join me. Our guest today is Dr. Philip Goodney. He's a vascular surgeon and health services researcher at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center in Hanover, New Hampshire. Dr. Goodney is director of the Center for the Evaluation of Surgical Care at Dartmouth, vice chair of research and surgery, and co-director of the VA Outcomes Group at White River Junction VA Medical Center. His projects examine associations between structural and patient-related variables and surgical outcomes, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. So welcome to Madison, and thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today, Dr. Goodney.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So you just gave a great grand rounds about some of the work that you're doing. It sort of covered three themes that were related, and I think incredibly interesting ideas that are going to be really relevant, not just to academic surgeons, but to community providers as well. The first of which was sort of talking about regionalization and the new thoughts on regionalization. Could you talk a little bit more about what we used to know about regionalization and maybe now what the subtle things that are causing us to think differently about it?
Sure. Well, you know, we try to tie each of these themes together in terms of what, you know, questions that patients ask us and how we might involve patients' concerns more directly in some of the research that we do. And much of our research, you know, in our group and many others across the country has looked at factors to try to make surgery safer for patients in terms of where they might have their operation performed. And many, you know, many investigators have seen that places who do more operations tend to have fewer complications. But getting patients to go to different hospitals can be hard for a variety of reasons. And then taking care of patients after surgery, if they have complications, especially if you didn't do the operation, can often be very difficult. And that's a problem that's not particular to one surgical specialty or another. We all see that, especially those who work in referral centers, as well as those who work in smaller community hospitals. So we wanted to test whether or not, you know, continuity care, so taking care of the patient both at the time you did the original operation as well as at the time of a readmission, mattered. And this, you know, I thought was a great idea. It was one of the ideas that one of my colleagues, his name is Ben Brook, came up with in the context of some of our volume analyses. And Ben thought, well, gosh, why don't we just compare the outcomes of those patients who are treated in continuity, meaning that they had their index operation and then their treatment for complication at the same treatment team, versus patients who went to disparate places, sometimes higher volume, sometimes lower volume. And Ben's hypothesis, and it was a pleasure to help him with this project, was that continuity would matter. And I think for both patients and for surgeons, we thought that it would. We all intrinsically, I think, like taking care of our own patients. And even when they have trouble, we all want to see those problems when they come back. And patients, similarly, you know, are more comfortable, I think, with their own treatment teams than when they get sent to some hospital that's a long way away and surgeons or healthcare providers are not familiar with. And it turned out that's exactly what the data showed. So even with a series of complex adjustments, it pretty consistently showed across a variety of operations that when you have your treatment by the same treatment team, those outcomes often are better. And those outcomes that were associated with continuity were actually even stronger than volume effects in many scenarios. So it showed for us that, you know, regionalization, while it might sound like a great idea on paper, has some, you know, fine points that might deserve a little more careful thought, because sending patients away if they have complications means that they might have to also return someplace that's a long way away from home. And when the recovery after an operation is long, like after esophagectomy or after aorobifemoral bypass, patients don't want to be away from home that long. So anything we can do to try to give them a good result close to home probably will be, you know, as we say, a patient-centered goal for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's something we face here in Wisconsin a lot as well, is, you know, our patients travel many hours to get to us, and trying to figure out that balance between how you keep patients, you know, at the center that can handle, that has the experience to handle complex problems, while at the same time making sure they spend as much time as possible in their community is been a huge priority for us. I mean, I think the story around volume relationships was cool because it was sort of disruptive, you know? Mm-hmm. But then there's this idea that, like, actually, you know, common sense can also be proven in a nice, rigorous, empiric way. I mean, this was a paper that was published in The Lancet, and I think that in a way is almost cooler. You know, this thing that we always sort of knew in the back of our minds was true, is demonstrated.
Yeah, Ben did a great job in operationalizing, you know, the analyses, and you know, our team fortunately had a lot of experience in these large data sets. So really what we needed was sort of a good question, and this question fortunately was well suited to the tools. And you know, I've done health services research for a while, and it's always nice when, you know, when you come up with a question that has both clinical traction, like you're saying. You know, everybody knows that when you get that transfer of somebody who's had, you know, phone book worth of prior operations, then it's going to be hard to kind of figure out what's going on inside there if you hadn't done it yourself. When we can translate that to really a sort of a broadly generalizable finding, it really is pretty exciting. And I remember when we first started to look at the results and we kept seeing the same effect, that continuity was consistent and continuity mattered. I said, boy, this is really going to be impactful. And Ben did a great job of operationalizing that and coming up with the fancy analytics so that we could you know, really get it published in a high impact journal. So it's one of the things that makes surgical research fun.
Yeah, and you know, people who go and see your talk online will be able to see sort of exactly some of the statistical things that you did to prove that this is not a confounded bias thing, and the rigor that's now happening in health services research and how that's grown, I think, is one of the topics that you touch on in your grand rounds. But in the limited time we have here, I just wanted to talk about some of the other initiatives that you talked about. You have sort of a safer surgery arm in the work you do, where you specifically looked at smoking cessation and the value of that post-op time as a teachable moment and a time when we can intervene as surgeons. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. When we, you know, sort of had conceived this idea that we were going to focus on patient-centered research, I thought, well, what are some of the questions that matter to patients most? And all you have to really do is go to clinic to kind of figure those questions out, and then listen to patients when they ask you, well, gee, you know, what's going to happen up after the operation, and what risks am I facing, and how might I mitigate those risks? And in vascular surgery, one of the very common risks is, you know, things like post-op heart attacks or wound infections, or maybe the bypass graft clogging up. And stop and smoking helps tremendously with all those things, as well as helping the patient's overall health. So we knew it was sort of low-hanging fruit, but we also knew it was going to be a hard sort of row to hoe, if you will, in terms of helping those patients quit. And so part of that initiative and that trial that we conducted was to try to find a systematic way that surgeons might be a sort of a leader in that effort. When we first started that, there was a bit of pushback, you know, because surgeons thought, well, just isn't that the primary care doctor's job? And I've got three patients waiting in clinic, and I, you know, they've already heard from 10 other doctors to stop smoking. Listening to me isn't going to matter. But I think that's actually where the true missed opportunity was. The social scientists call this sort of the teachable moment phenomenon, where patients are really much more likely, and Susan Flock is the social scientist that led this effort. And Susan thinks that, you know, the patients are much more likely to listen to empathetic advice at that key time because, well, gee, you know, I've heard it before, but now I have to have an operation. Now I've got to be in the hospital. Now I've got to have a recovery. It's going to cost me time and money and place. Maybe I should quit. And if the surgeon can capitalize on that opportunity and really help push the patient over the edge, that there might be, you know, sort of some effect that they can finally make that leap into smoking cessation. And so we designed a trial to test that hypothesis. We had to design a way for smoking cessation to happen efficiently so it could happen in surgeons' offices. And so we worked very carefully to do that. And then we actually tested it across 8 sites across the country to make sure it could be done. Turns out it was quite feasible. And then what was exciting was it turned out actually seemed to have an effect. So, you know, patients were about 40% much more likely to quit in our intervention sites compared to our controls, meaning that this QI intervention made them more likely to quit smoking, even with just sort of simple everyday measures just delivered at that key time. So our next goal is to broaden that pilot trial, which was just conducted at 8 sites, into about a 50-site trial that we would conduct nationally in combination with PCORI. So we have a grant into them that we're going to revise and resubmit for the summer, and that's what's at the top of my to-do list for the next several months.
Yeah, absolutely. And that intervention is a really straightforward thing. I mean, it really is. It's have that conversation with patients, advise them to stop smoking. It's provide them nicotine replacement, and it's give them the number for the quit line that exists in every state.
And the good thing about this is the surgeon actually only has to do one of those things. We were under no misconception that surgeons had plenty of time for this. We know that everybody's busy. So we tried to make it very efficient and also make those tasks be able to be amortized over the people in your clinic. So we gave people, you know, the ability to sort of pre-print their nicotine replacement prescriptions so that your nurse could take care of that. And similarly, we printed out fax forms so that your medical secretary could take care of the quit line referral. So really the only thing that was left for the surgeon for this sort of evidence-based smoking cessation intervention, the only thing that was left for the the surgeon to do was to administer the what we call very brief advice, which is very direct advice that, you know, it's important for me to quit smoking, it's important for your health, the results of your operation will be better, and your health will be better, and I want you to give it your best shot, and I want to help you try by giving you nicotine replacement and having you call this longitudinal counseling service. So it doesn't take any longer than what I just said to you, so 10 or 20 seconds, but we found that it can be an important adjunct in making sure that patients actually get a good chance at trying to quit.
Yeah, and I think empowering for surgeons, because I think it's so easy now to sort of consider yourself like a bit of a widget in the operating room. And it's easy to forget that that interpersonal relationship that we have with patients and the outsized role that we play in patients' perceptions of their hospital stay, you know, from the brief time we see them pre and post-op, you know, on rounds, is profoundly affecting to them, even though we may see, you know, 30 patients that day. You know, that moment when the surgeon walks in the room and says something, like, they remember it, they call their husband and tell them what the surgeon just said. I mean, it's an immensely powerful moment. I think it's really cool that you're taking advantage of that.
Especially when it's delivered, you know, because we all see patients that we follow over time, and, you know, maybe everybody doesn't need an operation every time they come to clinic, but that clinic visit where the decision is made that, yep, you know, the time has come, we're going to need to do an operation. I think you're right. There is sort of some gravity to that scenario that where if you deliver that key advice at that opportune time, that it's probably more likely to, for the patient to really think about making that change. And Susan's group, her research is also funded by PCORI in terms of emphasizing that teachable moment. Because if you think about it, there's a couple of different ways you can deliver that advice. You can say, you have to stop smoking, your operation's going to be terrible otherwise, and you really need to quit tomorrow. And that's in sort of a scary and non-empathetic way. And Susan really taught us that there's an empathetic and effective approach to hear the patient's concern and then try to, you know, use those concerns to help them quit in the most effective way. So it was, you know, I learned a lot over the course of doing the project, as you do with any research project. And I think it has made us do a better job, even outside of our trial, at trying to help our patients quit.
Yeah, and one of the things you really focused on, it sounds like, is patient stories and using sort of that narrative, using that, like putting a face and a name and a, you showed a video of one of your patients who agreed to sort of be part of this outreach effort that, you know, I think doing that, showing an individual with a story is so much more powerful than showing someone a PowerPoint slide that says you have a 40% decreased risk of stroke, you know?
You know, and that's exactly what the psychiatrist that we partnered with here, you know, told us. And these are a group of addiction psychiatrists, and Mary Burnett is a leader of that group. And it's really remarkable, especially for somebody, you know, my research is focused on, you know, as you alluded to, a bunch of big data and risk, you know, assessments and things like that. But she said, what's most likely to convince patients to make change is often testimonials, and patients like hearing from patients like them. So I think this is one of the, you know, doing research in surgery is hard, and we all know that. But I think one of the distinct advantages we have is that, especially for those of us who are clinical investigators, who have clinical practices, is often you can find those patients who are trying to, you know, help you address that very same research question you're asking. So it wasn't hard for us at all in our group to find a patient who was struggling with that, very same challenge of trying to quit smoking. And so they fit perfectly into this sort of testimonial that she wanted us to come up, to find patients who would help and share with us. So now Mr. Spain was a delight and really told a very compelling and very meaningful story in terms of how he was able to quit and how it ultimately helped him recover after surgery.
Yeah. And what clearly shows the power of your group is that, like, you discovered this, right? You discovered that it was extremely helpful and very cool to have patients involved in your process and really sort of take the fore in this sort of patient-centered outcomes research effort that is obviously why you're getting all of this PCORI support. But you've actually, like, taken that whole idea and actually started researching the way that you get patients to be involved in research. Like, you've gone meta.
Exactly right. Well, you know, so we, and as I said in Grand Rounds, you know, we ultimately weren't funded in our first trial application for a large pragmatic study. You know, as I say, when you get lemons, you make lemonade. And we sort of looked at the work we had done. We said, well, gosh, we've already engaged. We've learned how to really tie patients into our research. I think we did a good job at that. We had, you know, on this order of 70 or 80 patients that were involved in some one various aspect of our research or another. We had this big compendium of experience around garnering patient engagement and involvement in research. And then we looked and said, well, gosh, we can use this to apply for different grants. And, you know, lo and behold, our educational plan, and this was under the direction of Addy Ferber, who's one of my social scientists that has been an important partner over time. We formalized the process that she had learned to engage patients in research, and that was funded for PCORI Engagement Award. And then similarly, helping patients understand these complex risks was a value to a biostatistician in our group, James O'Malley. So he was able to leverage that experience and put forward a PCORI application to both improve methodological analyses and also improve the way patients understand them. So it turned out that the work we had done, while it didn't fund the original goal, it helped to fund two other goals. So, you know, but ultimately it's turned up some unexpected results and some unexpected funding, which is great. And those projects will be exciting and hopefully help us continue to move on towards our larger trial too.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come to Wisconsin and talk to us today and taking the time to talk to our listeners out there across the world here in the podcast about this amazing work that you're doing with patients and stories. And I definitely recommend, you know, everyone listening to us today to go to our website at surgery.wisca.edu and watch the full Grand Rounds presentation, because it's totally worth your time. But thanks again for coming in.
Thanks very much, John. Pleasure to be here.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Surgery Set. In our next episode, we welcome Dr. Oya Andacholo, who will talk about her experiences as an international surgery resident and everything she knows about living donor liver transplantation. The Surgery Set is a production of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This episode was produced by Rebecca Wazileski and myself. It was audio engineered by Chris Hansen and edited by Alex Worley. Our theme song is On Wisconsin, arranged and produced by Jamie Schmidt. I encourage you to visit us at surgery.wisc.edu, where you can find links to Grand Rounds, free CME credits, and more. You can also check out the UW School of Medicine and Public Health Video Library for a wide range of medical education resources at videos.med.wisc.edu. In addition, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. And of course, you can follow us on social media. You can like our Facebook page and also find us on Twitter at Wisc Surgery, as well as me at J.E. Kohler. Please feel free to let us know how we're doing, and especially let us know if there are topics you'd like us to cover. Thanks, and we hope you check back soon.